Don't you want the Republicans to wake up? The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
You've got the very latest Peter B. Collins Show. Available as long as your First, Fourth, and Fifth Amendment rights are in full effect. And that is in some dispute. This program is sponsored by listeners who subscribe, including Kathleen Emmer, Janet Price, Gary Washington, and Michelle L. Pasco. Thank you for your support. In our second segment, we'll be joined by Shahid Buttar. He's Executive Director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. And we'll talk about the various assaults on our liberties, our rights, and our freedoms. But first, to a specific case that we've been following for a little too long now, and it heads into its appeals process. We're talking about the Al Haramain case. They sued the United States government because lawyers for that Islamic charity were wiretapped, and they knew it. John Eisenberg is the intrepid attorney who has been shepherding this case forward, and he joins us again today. Hello, John.
Hello, Peter. Thanks for having me back on the show.
Well, it's my pleasure, and you continue this important battle for our freedoms and for accountability for the lawbreaking that I believe occurred under the so-called warrantless wiretapping program. And the uber-liberal Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, based here in San Francisco, a three-judge panel unanimously overturned the decision of trial court Judge Vaughn Walker, who ruled in your favor, awarded $40,000 in damages and $2.5 million in attorney's fees. Are you surprised at this turn of events, John Eisenberg?
I'm not surprised after the course of oral argument on June 1st of this year. Before June 1st, if you had told me this would happen, I would have been shocked. But we got an inkling of this coming down the pike at the oral argument. So I was prepared for this. I never expected during the past 5 years that this case would be thrown out on the issue of sovereign immunity, because we litigated that issue in the Ninth Circuit 5 years ago, and in their opinion, they didn't address it. So we had no clue that they considered it a problem. In that respect, I'm really shocked.
Well, I'm interested in hearing more about this, because when I first read about this in the news accounts, I thought, well, gosh, that should have been litigated. That would have been one of the initial arguments of the government once they, got past the standing issue and whether you could prove that your clients had been wiretapped. That's a fundamental issue at the trial court level. So my guess was that it was one of those secret briefs that you weren't allowed to see, and the argument was made in your absence, and perhaps that day that you shredded the banana, you failed to consider that as a possible argument that could be raised and that you should therefore prospectively respond to.
Well, that shows some rational thinking on your part, Peter.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But yes, that's the problem. Nothing about this case has been rational. Maybe we should step back and explain what sovereign immunity means.
All right.
That means that the sovereign, the government, cannot be sued unless the sovereign, the government, consents to being sued. So generally, you, a citizen, cannot sue the United States unless the United States agrees that you may sue. And there are a number of statutes that allow that to happen. For example, if a tort is committed against you by a federal employee. FISA says says that a person who can sue, in defining a person, includes a federal officer or an a federal officer or employee. And so we had assumed all along that that was a waiver of sovereign immunity. When the case went up to the Ninth Circuit the first time in 2007, the government asserted that that was not a waiver of sovereign immunity, and by that I mean consent for the government to be sued. The government argued that the phrase officer or employee of the federal government in the FISA statute simply meant in their individual capacities. You could sue the FBI director individually for wiretapping, but you couldn't sue him in his role as FBI director. You couldn't sue President Bush or President Obama.
Mm-hmm.
The government asserted this defense in 2007 in the Ninth Circuit. We opposed that assertion, and we briefed the issue thoroughly. When the opinion came out, nothing in the opinion addressed the assertion of sovereign immunity. What the court said back in 2007 is, you, we, the plaintiffs, you can't use the secret document to prove standing if the state secrets privilege applies to this case.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to send this case back to Judge Von Walker for him to decide whether the privilege applies or whether, conversely, provisions of FISA preempt or replace the state secrets privilege and allow the case to be litigated under secure conditions. So what the Ninth Circuit did was they said, they sent the case back to Walker, and they said, you decide whether this case can go forward outside the state secrets privilege. Didn't say a word about sovereign immunity, not one word. So we went back to Walker. The government asserted sovereign immunity before him again. He rejected that defense. He found that FISA preempts the state secrets privilege. He found that eventually we gave up using the document and went forward on public evidence. He found that our public evidence established that our clients were surveilled without a warrant, and he ruled for us and awarded damages. Back the case goes to the Ninth Circuit, the government still asserting sovereign immunity, and this time the court, 5 years later, said, well, we find there is sovereign immunity and you can't sue. And end of case. Your clients may have been wiretapped. It may have been legal or illegal, may or may not have been wiretapped, but it doesn't matter. Even if they were, and even if it's illegal, even if it was illegal, you can't sue anybody for it. You can't sue the government for the warrantless wiretapping, period. End of case. Which leaves me feeling, well, I wish they'd told me that 5 years ago. It would have saved me and Von Walker a lot of our time.
Now, this seems like a trap of some kind, a catch that was in place before, but you just described that not only was the appeals court silent on the arguments that you raised about this, but that Judge Walker affirmatively ruled in your favor. So they're overturning Walker's finding in that narrow respect. Is that how we should interpret this?
That is correct. And now your rational thinking is getting you somewhere. Yes, Judge Walker said there's no sovereign immunity here. After all, FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, was enacted to address warrantless wiretapping by the executive, by the president. That's why FISA came into being. It wouldn't make any sense at all for Congress to make it illegal for the president, the federal government, to wiretap without a warrant, but then leave no remedy. I mean, there is a statute, it's a 50 U.S. Code 1810, that says the victim of warrantless wiretapping may sue.
Mm-hmm.
The perpetrator may sue a person for warrantless wiretapping. What this court is saying is that, well, you can sue somebody, but you can't sue the federal government. Well, who else is going to be doing the wiretapping, and who else was the target of the FISA law in the first place?
Well, and there's no third party here. It's not a telecom wiretap.
Well, you could sue the telecoms. They did it, except, oops, guess what happened in 2008?
Well,
Congress gave them immunity.
Right, they were immunized. I understand that. But there wasn't even a telecom party to this interception.
Well, we didn't
that we know of.
We didn't name any telecoms.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's something we thought about way back when. Should we be suing the telecoms in addition to the government?
Mm-hmm.
As did the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Straight off, they sued AT&T. We chose not to do that. We chose to go straight after the perpetrators, so President Bush
mm-hmm.
and his colleagues. Really, who does the wiretapping? The telecom does it on behalf of the government. So that's who you can sue. You can either sue the telecoms or you can sue the government. Now, suing the telecoms is no longer was an option, but Congress mm-hmm. gave them retroactive immunity.
Right.
Which means, oh, they're out of the picture, can't sue them now. Now, this court has said you can't sue the federal government either. So in the way I see things, FISA was crippled by Congress, crippled to the extent that the telecoms were given retroactive immunity. This decision kills FISA, kills it off completely, because not only can you not sue the telecoms, you can't sue the government. Who's left to sue?
Well, and if there is no remedy, then the law is neutered.
Neutered is one way you might put it, Peter.
It's just a formality, and
yes.
It is barely observed in the wake of those 08 reforms.
It leaves one wondering, at least one lacking a certain degree of respect to the law. What must one think of a law that makes it illegal, a crime, to do something, but provides no remedy?
And it also provides criminal penalties.
Yes, but who's going to do the prosecuting? The government who did the wiretapping? They're not about to prosecute themselves, right? That's
yeah.
why Congress created a civil remedy, because Congress understood that the president who's doing the unlawful wiretapping is not likely to order his Justice Department to prosecute him for doing the unlawful wiretapping.
Mm-hmm.
That's why there's a civil remedy, because the only hope for accountability is in a civil suit by the victim. The victim has huge hurdles to overcome because of the secrecy involved. We managed to overcome those hurdles without using any classified documents, which was probably the one and only time that's ever going to happen in the history of FISA past and future.
Yeah.
But we managed to do it, and now we're told, well, we respect the integrity with which you have litigated this case, which the opinion said, and I appreciate that expression from the court. We respect what you've done, but you're going to lose because we say you can't sue the government, period. There's been no express waiver of sovereign immunity. End of case. So, as I say, Congress crippled FISA in 2008 with the FISA Amendments Act, and this court has killed it off completely, in my view.
Now, John, zooming out for a moment from the specifics of the FISA law to the broader protections of the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, is there any way to raise those issues? Because it seems fundamental to me that the clear language of the Fourth Amendment is in direct conflict with the outcome of this ruling.
Well, when it comes to the Fourth Amendment litigation, the problem of the state secrets privilege arises. What made it possible for us to go so far in the Al Haramain case was that we were litigating this case under FISA rather than the Fourth Amendment. Instead of asserting violation of the Fourth Amendment, we asserted a violation of FISA, which allowed us to invoke its secrecy provisions that allow litigation outside the state secrets privilege.
I see.
In a regular Fourth Amendment case, the government's going to come back and say, I mean, if stepping back, if we had litigated only the Fourth Amendment claims in our case, the government would have said, you can't do it, we assert the state secrets privilege, you're out. But by proceeding under FISA, we were able to invoke provisions that allow you to go forward outside the state secrets privilege, but still with some procedural safeguards in place to litigate certain issues without endangering national security. In a Fourth Amendment case, you're completely at the mercy of the state secrets privilege.
And the only way to fix this murky precedent, it's not even a piece of legislation, would be through congressional action, because the courts have refused to really establish any standard or any transparent interpretation of the state secrets privilege. It's essentially applied on a case-by-case basis, and the standard for application seems to decline each time it's applied.
True, and the legislation to reform the state secrets privilege statutorily has been bouncing around in Congress for a few years, but it's gotten nowhere.
Yeah.
So, state secrets privilege is alive and well under the Obama administration, unfortunately, and in fact invoked just as frequently by President Obama as it was by President Bush.
Yeah, yeah, it's really, really alarming. So you're kind of boxed in, and as a result, we the people are kind of screwed. Next step is an appeal to the full Ninth Circuit, the en banc?
Well, we have actually three options that we could pursue. One would be to petition for a rehearing just by this panel on the ground that they failed to address one of our key arguments on sovereign immunity.
Mm-hmm.
Which they did. They failed to address one issue. Second option would be to petition for a rehearing en banc by a larger panel of the same court. And a final option would be a petition for writ of certiorari in the U.S. Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
What have we decided to do? We don't know yet. We haven't decided. We're still puzzling over this thing and trying to figure out what to do next, if anything.
Mm-hmm. Just resting an option here? Do you feel like, you know, the odds are so stacked against you that it's hardly worth the effort to further appeal it?
Well, it doesn't look good, but we have been in positions in this litigation before where I thought we were dead and gone, and we weren't. We managed to survive. The question I'm asking myself at this point is, what do we achieve by continuing to pursue this? What's our goal here? What point are we trying to make? We commenced this litigation with the goal of establishing the point that warrantless wiretapping is illegal, the violation of FISA. That's what we set out to do. It seems that what we achieved instead is to make the point that Bush got away with it and can get away with it, and every president after him, because where we've ended up with is a ruling that the federal government may not be sued under FISA. So, I mean, that's a good point to have made, I think, that our justice system doesn't always work, and it hasn't worked when it comes to holding President George W. Bush accountable for warrantless wiretapping. I don't feel really good about having made that point.
Mm-hmm.
Not what I set out to do. What do we do now? I mean, in a way, my feeling is you don't give up. You just fight until it's over. You run out that last routine fly ball with two outs in the bottom of the ninth. It's just how you do it. It's how you play the game, if you want to put it that way, or fight the war, or just how one should litigate. And so in that respect, I feel like it's not time to quit yet. On the other hand, if I think about what we're trying to do in this case, maybe it is time to quit. Maybe we've made our point, which is something's not working here. I don't know. I haven't figured it out yet. We have, I think, 42 more days to decide.
Well, if I can lobby you, I do encourage you to fight this out to the bitter end, because it is our last and best hope to expose the dimensions, the motivation, and the law-breaking that was part and parcel of this program. And let me invite you to visit my website and listen to a recent interview with Diane Rourke. Do you know who she is?
No, please don't.
She was a staffer on the House Intelligence Committee, and she opposed the warrantless wiretapping, as it's described. I always call it illegal, because it was. She was working internally. And in 2002, she wrote a series of memos to Porter Goss, the chair of House Intelligence, and to Nancy Pelosi, the ranking member. And she aired out her opposition on constitutional grounds. And also, there was this internal struggle at NSA over two types of software used to monitor and filter the intercepted traffic. And the Trailblazer program, which ended up costing more than $3 billion, explicitly did not protect constitutional rights of Americans in the United States. It was allowed to continue and fester, while a much cheaper program that cost about $3 million, called ThinThread, did have built-in protections to avoid violating the constitutional rights of Americans in the United States. And this was the focus of the Thomas Drake prosecution.
Yes.
That fell apart a year ago, and he ended up taking a plea on misuse of a government computer. But if you followed that, Rourke was in the wake of the Drake investigation. They raided her home, seized a computer, and they have turned a former House intelligence staffer into an opponent who is the subject of retaliation. And in my conversation with Diane Rourke, she flatly said, and she's briefed on this program much more than I will ever know, she said it is wrong and is unnecessary. And so I do consider this, John, to be one of the most egregious erosions of our constitutional rights. It's been done in broad daylight since 2005, when the New York Times finally exposed it. We have political leaders who are willing to go along with it because the public doesn't raise it as an issue and hold them accountable. And the other thing that Rourke said was that she acknowledged that the oversight role of Congress has been just indescribably awful since 9/11. And then when you look at the collusion of the courts, who will not challenge the executive and who offer lame explanations, well, it's really up to the legislative, our system of checks and balances is failing miserably.
Well, that's what we're confronting now. I'm dealing with a court that didn't deal with all my arguments. You know, some of my best arguments, I thought the court dealt with it by ignoring them completely. Now, do I go back to that court and say, will you please consider the arguments that I made? Do I go to another court, another panel within that court? I go to the U.S. Supreme Court. It's a little, more than a little, distressing when Congress isn't doing anything about the executive overreach, and you go to the courts and they're not either. President Bush has overreached. President Obama is continuing the overreaching. I can't believe it would be any different under a President Romney.
Mm-hmm.
I'm using those two words together, though. I mean, where do we go at this point?
Yeah,
I don't know the answer to this question, and you're catching me at a time when I just, you know, I'm reading a really bad decision.
Yeah.
So, you know, most likely I'll wake up tomorrow morning, feel renewed and energized, and get back to fighting the battle. But, you know, right now I'm looking at this and I'm perplexed. I'm thinking, well, the executive does a considerable amount of overreaching. Congress rolls over and said, fine, leave us out of it, and then the courts do the same.
Well, it's kind of like the Three Stooges, and Moe is in charge.
Wow, the Three Stooges. So is that how we should be teaching civics in high school now? You know, the three branches of government are Larry, Moe, and Curly?
It's his fault. It's his fault. It's his fault.
Great.
Nyuk, nyuk, nyuk.
Indeed.
John, just one other thing that occurs to me. You mentioned the oral arguments in June. And that gave you some inkling. Was it around the sovereign immunity issue, or did the government operate with a different tone or a different set of arguments than you had anticipated?
It was all about sovereign immunity. At oral argument, I stood at the lectern, and the lead judge in the case looked at me and said fairly soon into the argument, well, we have this issue of sovereign immunity here today, which was not on the table when the case was before us in 2007. And I sat there, or I stood there, rather stunned because the case was on the table. The issue was on the table in 2007. It had been put to them, and I thought, oh my goodness, what do I do now when the lead judge in the case isn't aware that the primary issue here was before them 5 years ago and they ignored it? What do you do? Do you say, excuse me, Your Honor, you're wrong? Which he's not going to find too pleasing.
So how did you respond? Did you say, the record will show, Your Honor?
Well, I could have done that. It's tough. It's a tough decision to make in the heat of battle. Do I embarrass her? What do I achieve by embarrassing her and telling her, excuse me, Your Honor, but where have you been? This issue was before you 5 years ago and you ducked it. I mean, I don't really, as an advocate, I don't achieve much by embarrassing her in a courtroom full of people.
And this is Margaret McCune?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So I said nothing.
And, pardon me, was she on the original panel in 07?
She was. Not only was she on the original panel, she wrote the decision in 07.
Oh.
So here it is, the author of the decision saying to me from the bench, well, we have an issue here that wasn't before us 5 years ago. And I'm at the lectern thinking, well, what do I do here? Do I correct her and embarrass her? Do I just let it go? And I didn't feel I would gain anything by embarrassing her, by correcting her, so I let it go.
Wow.
But
can this be raised in your next round of appeals to show that the court, in its best efforts, failed to recognize the argument from the previous round?
Well, what does that get me? It's not error. It's just it's something else. But it's not a reversible error by her. Just because she misspoke from the bench, I mean, did she not remember? I guess she just didn't remember. I don't achieve anything as an advocate in bringing that up to her. So, no, it's nothing usable. It's just maddening.
Wow.
It's personally maddening for me. Is what she did a reversible error? No. It's maddening to me, and it ought to be embarrassing to her, but unless she's listening to your show, I don't think she's going to figure it out.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, that's right. Wow. So here I am. I got probably 2,000 hours of my own time into this case between 2007 and now, maybe a bit more than that.
Mm-hmm.
My colleagues have maybe another couple thousand hours into it. Von Walker, Lord knows he put a lot of time into this case, and it all could have been avoided had they decided the issue of sovereign immunity 5 years ago.
One of the things that you told me after Judge Walker had ruled was that you felt that he wrote his decision with Justice Kennedy in mind, and that some of the arguments he raised, some of the precedents he cited, you thought were aimed at the swing vote on the Supreme Court. Given this new wrinkle with the return of the beast called sovereign immunity, do you still hold that hope that Walker's original decision would be viewed favorably by Justice Kennedy?
Well, what I was speaking of was Walker's decision on FISA preemption and ability to prove you've been wiretapped and standing, and ultimately the legality of the program. I wasn't even thinking about sovereign immunity because, you know, for years we went on believing if the Ninth Circuit cared so little about this issue as to not even mention it in its first decision, then probably we don't have much to worry about. So all of my analysis, all of my forward-looking thinking was geared toward the substantive issues.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't worrying about sovereign immunity when no one else seemed to be worrying about it.
Well, and this may be crazy-making for you, but since I wasn't trained in the law, I can think outside the law and the box. And I'm just thinking of the whole principle of double jeopardy, that you can't be tried twice for the same crime. And it seems that there ought to be some issue about arguments, that if you raised it and it wasn't addressed, that they can't have a second bite at that proverbial apple.
Well, okay, I mean, just putting all the legalese aside, you look at this and you think, this just isn't right. Pardon me, my fax machine's firing there.
That's right.
If you can hear the ring. It just, you look at it and you think, this isn't right. They should have litigated this issue 5 years ago. The government didn't, excuse me, the court didn't seemed out of problem. Now why all of a sudden, 5 years later, is it a big problem?
Gotcha.
Well, the problem with sovereign immunity is it's a jurisdictional issue. What that means is that if there's sovereign immunity, the court lacks any power to decide the case. And jurisdictional issues can be asserted at any time. It can't be waived. So, you know, under the law, 5 years later, it doesn't matter. So, to a lawyer, all of this can make sense, can make sense. To the average human, normal person, it's absurd.
Well, and to a schmo like me, John, it's just infuriating. This is Big Brother saying, you know, you can try all you want, but I've got all the cards, and I'm not going to give you any. And the fundamental rights in the Fourth Amendment and the due process elements, seem to me to just get thrown under that proverbial bus.
Well, let me tell you about an interesting experience I had about 7 or 8 years ago in the airport in Luang Prabang in northern Laos. My wife and I were traveling around Southeast Asia, and we were waiting for a flight out of Luang Prabang back to Bangkok, and we had some time to spend killing in the gift shop, which consisted of a rack of books. And in that rack of books was an English translation of the Laotian Constitution, which I believe some attorneys affiliated with the University of San Francisco had written, had drafted. And so I bought a copy of the Laotian Constitution, which has four branches of government, the fourth being the monarchy. And I read this document, and it was really a beautiful piece of work. It had separation of powers, it had constitutional rights, it had human rights embodied in there. It was gorgeous. But it was just a piece of paper, or rather a book, because in reality, it doesn't mean a thing unless these rights are enforced. And suffice it to say, there's a lot to be achieved in the future in the nature of human rights in Laos. So, you know, I spending my hour on the airplane flying from Luang Prabang back to Bangkok, I sort of learned the lesson of constitutional rights don't mean much if they aren't enforced or enforceable.
Well, John, thanks for fighting for hours. Is there anything you want to add that I didn't think to ask you about?
If you didn't think of it, Peter, I'm sure I wouldn't have thought of it. We've covered a lot of ground. How many times have I been on your show? Maybe five times?
Oh, it's more than that. I've lost track. Yeah.
We've covered a lot of ground, and it's been fun. It really has. So.
Well, I encourage you to fight this as far as you reasonably can, and if you decide to roll up your tent, I will understand. I will not be bitter or try to make you feel guilty. But
well, we'll find somewhere else to fight the battle.
Okay.
Okay?
John Eisenberg, thanks for doing it.
Thank you.
The fight for the Bill of Rights and our constitutional rights continues. Shahid Buttar returns.
This is not America. Sha-la-la-la-la.
Little piece of you. A little piece in me. Well,
this is not a miracle.
A little piece of you. A little piece of me will die. I'm feeling that sense of loss. We just concluded our conversation with John Eisenberg regarding the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals overturning the verdict that was in favor of the plaintiffs who were able to prove that they were wiretapped, and retired federal district court judge Vaughn Walker wrote the opinion, giving them a verdict in their favor and a penalty to be paid by the government, about a $40,000 fine, and attorney's fees of $2.5 million. And against that backdrop, we turn to Shahid Buttar. He's been on our program many times. He's an attorney and the executive director of BORDC, the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. Shahid, always a pleasure to fight with you to regain our constitutional rights.
Right on. Thank you, Peter. It's a pleasure to be back on your show.
And there are so many fronts to engage in. Before we talk about some of the other issues, did you want to comment about the wiretapping case? This comes on the heels of an interview that I just did and released this week, Shahid, with Diane Rourke, And Diane Rourke served on the House Intelligence Committee as one of their top staffers, had top security clearances, and her client, her caseload, was oversight over the National Security Administration, the NSA. And she retired after waging a fight internally to block the illegal wiretapping of American citizens that was launched in late 2001 or early 2002. And she flatly told me that the domestic surveillance program is not only wrong, that it's unnecessary. And yet we see the Obama legal team argue that an American citizen does not have the right to sue our government for illegal surveillance.
It's absolutely true. I mean, it's not only the case that the NSA's warrantless wiretapping scheme is constitutionally offensive and that it doesn't have any demonstrated national security benefit, but just reflecting on the case in the Ninth Circuit's dismissal of the Harmain case, it's a perfect example of the co-optation of our judiciary by an imperial executive branch run amok. And it's interesting to note that the support for the NSA's program within the administration predates certainly the Obama administration, but connects the Obama administration to the Bush administration. It's something they share very much in common. And Congress has been completely out to lunch, and the fact that the judiciary would insulate the program from challenge by dismissing suits, essentially allowing the government to hide behind executive secrecy, I think really reflects much of what is wrong with our federal government today.
And Shahid, this was the other point that was very clearly made by Diane Rourke. And by the way, she was a Republican staffer. She worked for Porter Goss. And yet she is, to me, a real hero who has stood up against the onslaught of the fear-mongering and the pressure to just go along with these unconstitutional activities. But one of the things that she said full-throated is that Congress has failed in its oversight obligations. And now with the uber-liberal Ninth Circuit ruling against the rights of citizens to sue over illegal wiretapping, two out of the three branches that are supposed to check and balance each other are basically asleep at the wheel.
That's right, and I think it has very terrifying implications for our democracy, right? The genius of our founders in constructing the American Republic and inviting the rest of the world to follow suit in the sort of adoption of democracy in the modern world is really predicated on a very simple notion, and that is you divide power and you separate it so that the separate powers can check each other. And the NSA's warrantless wiretapping scheme, this dragnet surveillance power that's just monitoring all Americans, regardless of if you've done anything wrong or have any reason to present suspicion, reflects the co-optation of those checks and balances. The executive branch here under George Bush pioneered a program that the executive branch under Barack Obama has continued. Congress, whether led by Democrats or Republicans, has, I would certainly, you know, echo Ms. Rourke's views, has just completely failed its oversight responsibilities. And the judiciary, which is, you know, the founders spoke explicitly in the Federalist Papers about the need for the judiciary to be independent, and the Ninth Circuit's willingness to back the executive here and to aggrandize the executive, to insulate it from a challenge, really reflects, I think, a broader problem with the judiciary generally, which is that it's lost its independence. Most federal judges, I don't know if most, but the most common career for federal judges before coming to the bench is serving as a prosecutor.
Right?
So we staffed the judiciary with people from the executive branch. And so in some respects, it's not surprising, but it should still concern us all a great deal, whether or not you're concerned about the particular privacy invasions of the wiretapping scheme, because this compromise and this loss of judicial independence will blow back in any number of arenas that we'll see going forward.
And one of the things that I hope for is that Judge Walker's opinion, which I expect to be appealed to the Supreme Court, was written with Justice Kennedy in mind, the swing vote in many of these critical cases. And so while on the one hand, I don't hold out a lot of positive vibe about the Supreme Court ruling in favor of the Fourth Amendment, I hold out a little bit of hope that Vaughn Walker, who was smart and clever as well, may be, you know, maybe his opinion as appealed will push the right buttons with Justice Kennedy, but that's something we'll have to see down the line.
That's right. Yeah, there's a lot of complexity and, I dare say, gamesmanship within the litigation process and judiciary in terms of trying to set up opinions for favorable treatment on appeal.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is like reading tea leaves, quite frankly. I mean, the Ninth Circuit's a perfect example. It has this reputation as being very liberal, but at the same time, it's also very libertarian. And yet you see the kind of decision, like the one in the Al-Haram Maine case, reflecting neither a liberal nor a libertarian perspective, you know, a much more establishmentarian perspective. And that, I think, really does defy any easy categorization.
Yeah. Well, Shahid, I want to turn to something that is at least a bit of a victory for those of us who care about the Bill of Rights. And that is, right here in San Francisco, Mayor Ed Lee had been toying with the idea, after he talked to Mayor Bloomberg in New York and a couple of other big city mayors, of trying to promote a stop and frisk law here in San Francisco. His rationale is that we have gun violence that he would like to stem, and that allowing cops to stop people on the streets and check them for weapons would make San Francisco a safer place. But we have seen the incredible abuse on a massive scale, even for New York City, which is, of course, a huge city, but on a per capita basis. The number of people who have been stopped and frisked in New York does represent a real intrusive form of law enforcement that cannot possibly be based on probable cause. And so I'd like to get your thoughts about the trend of stop and frisk and this victory on a policy level where progressives in San Francisco successfully pushed back on this new mayor, and he has now backed away from proposing any kind of a stop and frisk policy.
Absolutely. It's a great issue to raise, and it does reflect a rare victory and one that I think is really exciting. On the other hand, the way to think about the San Francisco proposal to adopt stop and frisk, it really, if it did succeed, it would have represented a really grand culmination of authoritarian power at the local level. The New York program, I would describe it as, you know, tyrannical, neocolonial, blatantly abusive. I mean, 80% of the people stopped in New York City are African American or Latino. 90% of them are never found to have done anything wrong. More African Americans are stopped in New York City every year than even live in the city, which is preposterous if you think about it. And the fact that San Francisco would even consider adopting so unapologetically abusive a program is itself ridiculous. If it stuck, given the politics of San Francisco, it would have represented, I think, a very profound problem in terms of giving cover to the New York program. So on the one hand, I would say that it's great that we stop and frisk in San Francisco. I want to give a particular shout-out to the Coalition for a Safe San Francisco, which has been mobilizing around policing issues in the city for a couple years now, first driven by surveillance issues, but you know, now demonstrating and seeing the connections between these different parts of the civil rights police accountability landscape. But you know, had rather than frame this as a victory that we should be very excited about and champion, I would just frame this as a victory that we really needed to have.
Yeah.
Because if stop and frisk took root in San Francisco, it would be all over the country within 6 months. And you know, the situation with mass incarceration is bad enough already. The stop and frisk program, it's almost like if mass incarceration and the way that students are being examined and profiled reflects a school-to-prison pipeline, the stop-and-frisk program is a street-to-prison pipeline. You know, it's like you don't have the right to walk the streets if you're a person of color, because just being on the streets means that cops are going to throw you up against a wall, you know, grope you, beat you up. You know, stop-and-frisk is a very innocuous way of describing it, right? I mean, stop-and-frisk is basically an opportunity for cops to instigate violence with people. And you either take it or you get charged with assaulting an officer, right? It's the gateway for all kinds of subsequent abuses. And I'm really glad that San Francisco managed to hold true to its roots in resisting that proposal.
I fully agree. And Shahid, to me, and I don't want to sound too cynical or snarky here, but cops already abuse their authority in arbitrary ways where they can simply assert after the fact that they had probable cause. They make things up. We've had the pattern of violence in Anaheim in Southern California where people of color who were unarmed end up dead, sometimes shot as they are handcuffed. And so, you know, to think that cops need another legal basis for law enforcement that is already on or over the edge of legality, I think is just absurd.
No question. And just to give you an example, I mean, and this is beyond police, but the way some of these pieces fit together, you know, if you're in an encounter with law enforcement, and let's say, you know, you say something to the cop that they don't like, and, you know, the cop is physical with you, you pretty much have to comply with anything a police officer does, however tyrannical, because if you do anything, even move in the wrong direction, it's pretty routine to get a charge of assaulting a police officer, even if you don't lift a finger, right? If you bump into a police officer by accident, they'll charge you with assaulting a police officer. And the way the prosecutors fit into this dynamic is once you're booked, they will throw the book at you. They'll charge you for things that you never even dreamed of being charged with, only to intimidate you and force you into a plea bargain on a lesser offense. You know, of the 2.3 million Americans in jail, I dare say the vast majority of them are innocent of any actual crime. But you end up getting coerced into pleas because if you fight the charge and are then found guilty, you're looking at astronomical penalties, you know, incarceration for decades. And I do think that we have gone well over the precipice in terms of giving police and intelligence agencies powers that should not be, we should not have in a free society. And I dare say the fact that the police have these kinds of powers means that we don't live in a free society, at least if the color of your skin is dark. And that's a problem not just for dark-colored people, right, like myself, but that's a problem for all Americans, because if any of us are not free, then we as a whole are not. And I think that that's something that all Americans, regardless of the color of our skin, regardless of our ideology, need to take very, very seriously. Because once one group is disfavored in that way, it's very easy for the lens to shift, and it can be any one of us next.
We're talking with Shahid Buttar. He's executive director of BORDC, Bill of Rights Defense Committee, their website, BORDC.org. And on your website right now, you are educating people about ERPA, the End Racial Profiling Act. Tell us about this, Shahid.
Now, the End Racial Profiling Act is a long overdue, much needed piece of legislation that would do a lot to address precisely the kinds of issues that we're talking about. It's been introduced in Congress for over 10 years now. It's not been enacted. It was the subject of a hearing in the Senate Judiciary Committee earlier this year, and what I think is really interesting about it is ERPA would fix, or perhaps a better way to put it is prevent, many of the kinds of problems that we've seen around the country, the kinds of abuses, for instance, happening in New York City under the Stop and Frisk program, the kinds of abuses we see in, you know, the shooting in Anaheim, the kinds of issues when Oscar Grant was shot on the BART platform in Fruitvale, you know, blatant disregard for the rights of racial and ethnic minorities. Across context, one of the most powerful pieces about the legislation, the End Racial Profiling Act, is that it applies cross context. It's not just drug investigations. It's not just traffic stops. It's not just stop and frisk. It's all that stuff. And that the breadth of the reform and the way in which it would protect African Americans alongside Latinos, alongside post 9/11 communities, is powerful, I think, in creating a vehicle for very diverse communities within the United States to find common cause and mobilize together. And that's when we're at our strongest, when we come together across our communities to raise our voices in concert in unison for shared values and the value and the opportunity to be treated on the basis of your actions, right? To quote Dr. King, the content of your character instead of the color of your skin is absolutely at the heart of the American dream. And so ERPA is nothing more than, I think, a realization of our constitutional principles that we happen to have thrown overboard. So it's absolutely needed. There are two other pieces of legislation that we're also suggesting that supporters advocate to the respective federal members of Congress. I'd love to touch on the Justice Act and the NDAA for a moment, if that's it.
Happy to do that, but first, just a little bit more about IRPA. What is the status of the bill? And one of the other questions that comes to mind, Shahid, is how we use federal legislation to influence the activities of local police officers. Is there enough strength in federal regulation of law enforcement to force a cop in Anaheim not to use racial profiling?
Great question. On that piece about the availability, the status of the legislation first, it has not been passed by either chamber of Congress, so neither the House nor the Senate have passed IRPA. Given the partisan alignment in D.C., I think it is somewhat unlikely that the House would pass it. But quite frankly, there's no excuse in the Senate for it to have not passed. Just as I would say there's no excuse for it to have not been passed by Congress in the first few years of the Obama administration. It's not entirely surprising that Republicans would not be terribly concerned about racial justice. But it does strike me as profoundly incongruous, perhaps, that Democrats, while relying on communities of color for their voting strength, when they had all the reins in Washington, couldn't see fit to even introduce this bill. And I think it's really astounding when you look at the president. His signature achievement as a senator, a state senator, that is, in Illinois, was a racial profiling bill. One of his friends on the Harvard faculty was racially profiled soon after he came in office. Obama rewarded the cop with a beer at the White House. The Trayvon Martin controversy springs this spring, and the president is silent on the central policy remedy that could actually fix these issues. And so I think it reflects, the status of the bill, that is, reflects a profound failure of elected leaders in Washington of the sort that maybe we would expect members of Congress who might describe themselves as conservative, and one that we should be very surprised, astounded, and dismayed by people who proclaim themselves to be allies of communities of color.
Well, and let me just pile on about the silence, because recently the president came to Oakland for a fundraiser. He held a fundraiser at the Fox Theater, which is a block away from Oaksterdam University, marijuana clinics that his goons have cracked down on. He didn't say anything about medical marijuana or about the breaking of his pledge to permit the state level distribution of medical marijuana to continue. There he was in Oakland on the day that a new report showed that we have achieved the dubious distinction of returning to the poverty levels of 1965. The president didn't say anything about poverty. And he went to Oakland, which is the, again this year, the number one murder capital of California, where gun violence kills people, including children under the age of five, on much too regular a basis. And likewise, he was silent about gun violence as he scooped up hundreds of thousands of dollars of campaign cash in Oakland.
From a community that is really cash starved, right, to a campaign that is among the most richly endowed in our country's history. I mean, it's not just appalling. I mean, I think that just reflects an incredible amount of audacity, quite frankly, for the Obama campaign to go to Oakland of all places. I mean, just some of my experiences in Oakland recently include standing at a rally for the murder of, I think the brother's name is Alan Bluford, who was shot and killed by the Oakland Police Department, young, unarmed black man. And, granted, that's a local policing issue. The president's failure to do anything at all to address these issues, whether in the context of supporting the End Racial Profiling Act, which I'll just note the administration actively impeded at the beginning of this administration, whether in the context of even just talking about it. I mean, the president has the biggest microphone in the country, and not once have I ever heard him speak about the need for police to take into serious consideration people's constitutional rights and to judge people, or not judge people, but to execute the law and enforce it in a colorblind fashion. I've never heard him say anything about that. And then to show up in Oakland just a few weeks after raiding the dispensaries is preposterous. dangerous, quite frankly. I'm amazed. I don't even know what to say about that. It is certainly disappointing, to say the least.
Yeah. And Shahid, I interjected there as I think you were about to answer my question about how we use a federal law to force local law enforcement to stop racial profiling.
Right. You're absolutely right to seize on the very different powers available to the federal government and state and local governments. And it's not always the answer to state and local abuses for the federal government to step in. Having said that, the End Racial Profiling Act is predicated on the spending clause, which is to say the way in which it would regulate local and state police is by conditioning Justice Department grants, which police agencies all over the country receive, on the compliance by local police with the standards that Congress would set, except that Congress refuses to set the standard.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of this abdication at the moment of federal authority, allowing state and local police departments to conduct what is essentially a race to the bottom.
And Shahid, would it also relate to Department of Homeland Security dollars? Because that's where the law enforcement party cash is coming from these days.
It is. You know, what would relate more closely to that is actually the Justice Act. The End Racial Profiling Act would be more squarely addressing the Justice Department pipeline and that money stream. The Justice Act would do a lot to curtail the DHS, Department of Homeland Security funding stream, particularly by requiring police intelligence collection and surveillance efforts to respect the constitutional requirement to have suspicion of people before monitoring them. At the moment, state and local police are, like their federal counterparts, engaged in a wholesale dragnet surveillance effort, and the Justice Act would do a great deal to stop that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I fully support the efforts to use the Justice Act to neuter some of the worst parts of the Patriot Act. And I wanted to share with you an anecdote that I learned about recently. Sarah Houghton is the librarian for the city of San Rafael here in Marin County. And she recently appeared on a TV broadcast that I moderated. And I asked her about Section 215 of the Patriot Act, the national security letters. And librarians have really been in the front line of defending our constitutional rights, at least at the library. And she told me something fascinating. I said, have you received an NSL, and what do you do with it? And she said, well, you know, we can only turn over data that we have. And she said, so our policy is that as long as you have borrowed a book and you have it out, we keep a record of that. And when you return it, we delete that record. And so they can come in and ask for the file on Peter B. Collins' lending history, and all they're going to find is the book that you currently have. And I said, all right!
Well, but realize, I mean, three things. One, just totally administratively and not that important. 215 is a little different than the NSL. The 215 orders are even more aggressive than the national security letters. NSL is a request for a document. The 215 authority allows the seizure of any tangible thing, like a hard drive, like a blood sample, you know, what have you. So the 215 orders are even worse in some respects than the NSLs. Second thing is if the librarian was served with an NSL, she would be at risk of criminal prosecution if she admitted it, because the NSLs come with gag orders. In fact, one of our Patriot Award winners every month, our organization, the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, awards a Patriot Award to a conscientious American who's been standing up to restore principles of the Bill of Rights. And so one of our Patriot Award winners, his name is Nicholas Merrill, based in New York. He is the only person, as far as I know, who has ever successfully resisted a national security letter. And he risked prosecution to do it, fought his case up through the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, and won. And so, at least in the Second Circuit, the government can't gag people when it serves them with these NSLs. And that opportunity for resistance, I think, is really important. Yeah. And the last piece I'd just say here is that to the extent the librarians are limiting the kinds of service that they might offer, I could see there being a good reason, perhaps, that you'd want the library to know what your last set of books were, right? Like, what if you want to go back to that series that you started a year ago and had to, hang up because you were going to do something else? There's a utility that you might choose for that sort of monitoring, except the fact that the government is now using it means that they can't collect it. So we're all made worse off because of these very thoughtful efforts, in this case of a librarian, to basically prevent the abuse of our rights. We pay a cost even for that.
Well, I agree, and also I just want to share your plaudits for Nick Merrill. I interviewed him with Sibel Edmonds for the Boiling Frog series. I think it was about a year and a half ago. And he is smart and has handled these issues very well. But he's also paid a price. Even though they never indicted him, it has harmed his business, and they've made life very difficult for him. And he has to live looking over his shoulder, waiting for the government to reappear.
That's right. So I would say that Nick is a stalwart and sufficiently principled young man that he's, I don't think, going to let himself be intimidated. But let me just note one other thing, though, as long as we're talking about IRPA and the Justice Act. There is a particular moment of opportunity this month. August 2012 is maybe the zenith of grassroots opportunity to affect real political change for two reasons. The first is Congress left Washington, and all the members are now back where they came from. And so grassroots individuals have more access to members of Congress over the next month than we do at basically any other time in the year. The second thing is, unlike most years, this happens to be a presidential election year. If members of Congress hear a groundswell from their constituents that we have concerns about police run amok in our streets, the NSA reading our emails, you know, the FBI serving these NSLs and intimidating people through them, or arresting activists for that matter, which is also happening, if we can make Congress hear that echo chamber over the next month, the fact that we now have 3 months afterward, when they're back in D.C. before the presidential election, means that we have a huge opportunity to shift the political debate, not just in Congress, but also in the presidential campaign. And I just go back to 2009 for a demonstration of how influential this time can be. It was August in 2009 when the Tea Party really burst onto the national scene, and it was because of the health care debate. They were bird-dogging members of Congress, showing up at their town hall saying, why are you doing this? And whatever you feel about the health care policy issue, the fact that the Tea Party was able to take such advantage of that month when members of Congress were back home reflects a similar opportunity that grassroots constitutionalists, whether conservative or progressive, can take advantage of this month. And do the same thing, to show up at town halls, ask the tough questions. Why you, Senator whomever, Boxer or Feinstein perhaps, haven't supported the Justice Act? You know, why haven't you supported the Unracial Profiling Act? Why did you vote for the National Defense Authorization Act, even though it allows the military to detain Americans without trial, without an opportunity to contest evidence, without an opportunity to prove your innocence, to force them on the record and to make them feel some heat? This is the best opportunity we're going to get. And so I just very strongly urge your listeners to visit BORDC.org, check out the action menu, and take action in your local community. This month is a great way to do it.
And Shahid, I have tried to set an example for my listeners by annoying Leader Pelosi, Senator Boxer, Congressman Thompson, who's on the Intelligence Committee. I see them, you know, in these benign contexts, and I just look right at them and I say, I want my Fourth Amendment back.
As well you should, and they need to hear that.
Yes, they do.
They need to hear that from you, they need to hear it from me, they need to hear it from all of our supporters and all of your listeners. And when they hear it from all Americans who actually share these concerns, then we'll have a chance of getting that Fourth Amendment back and restoring the promise of liberty that has long made our country great.
Shahid, you referenced the NDAA, and I have been ranting about that since last December when it first surfaced. And we've talked with Carl Mayer, the attorney who carried the case for Chris Hedges, Dan Ellsberg, and other plaintiffs who successfully challenged it, and Catherine Forrest, a federal district judge in New York, ruled once very clearly, putting the Homeland Battlefield bill, that portion of the NDAA, on suspension. And when challenged by the government, she clarified her ruling. And so I give her credit for taking a very strong position. Has that been further appealed? Do you know the status of her ruling on the section of the law that permits the detention of Americans accused of terrorism indefinitely without charge at a military base?
I can give you an update on the status. And just to even, you know, tweak the framing, the law not only gives the government the right to detain people accused of terrorism, but also people accused of any belligerent act. You know, you don't have to be accused of terrorism to be detained under the NDAA. Mm-hmm. And a belligerent act, quite frankly, could be anything. It could be anything from standing on the street corner screaming at 3 a.m. to shutting down the ports the way the Occupy movement did on the West Coast in December. You know, those weren't acts of terrorism by any stretch, but they certainly could have been called belligerent acts, and that would, under the NDAA, qualify them for domestic indefinite military detention without trial. Judge Forrest's ruling, there was actually just a hearing in that case yesterday in New York, and I understand that the government has appealed her preliminary injunction. I would also just take a moment to recategorize her ruling as not a position, right, because we don't want judges to take positions, but we want them to rule as impartial arbiters on the cases that come before them. And Judge Forrest did what we would expect any thoughtful judge in a free country to do, which was demonstrate the independence that much of the judiciary has not shown, that, for instance, the Ninth Circuit did not show in the Al-Haramain case. She issued a preliminary injunction. The government has appealed it. Yesterday's hearing was actually on the permanent injunction that has also been sought by the journalists, Chris Hedges and Daniel Ellsberg and the others.
Mm-hmm.
When the ruling is expected is anyone's guess. I understand from the hearing that it went much like the preliminary injunction hearing, in the sense that Judge Forrest asked the government whether or not the plaintiffs were at risk of military detention, and the government, you know, the best they could do is say that on the basis of what they know about what the plaintiffs had done in the past, that they were not, but that they couldn't rule out the possibility of military detention in the future. And that's exactly why we should all be concerned, because powers that the government cannot articulate the limits of are limitless powers, and limitless powers are the kinds that lead to authoritarian totalitarianism.
Mm-hmm.
And it's crucial that we recognize the need to restore checks and balances on executive power. The NDAA is, to this point, the high watermark of the war on terror. I mean, we have absolutely adopted powers that we fought the Cold War explicitly against. These are the kinds of powers that in Egypt, the Arab Spring, you know, the Tahrir Square Revolution, cited the emergency detention law that had been in place in Egypt for 50 years as one of its central causes for concern. And we've adopted them here in the United States, the land that claims to be free, but has now lost the right to trial and the presumption of innocence. These are fundamental norms that are absolutely necessary to protect freedom. And the NDAA is a disturbing, terrifying threat to those rights and freedoms. And unless the NDAA's detention provisions are repealed before President Obama leaves office, democracy in America will hang by a thread. It is a sword of Damocles looming over our country. And I would just once again plead with your listeners to take advantage of this August to visit your members of Congress and say, I am a constituent. I am worried about these issues. I appreciate the presumption of innocence. I appreciate the right to trial. I am an American, not a citizen of the Soviet Union. And I expect you, our elected leaders, to act like it.
And, Shahid, it is not a stretch to connect the egregious elements of the NDAA with what we now know about the president's so-called kill or capture program.
That's absolutely right.
The silence, the incredible acquiescence to the revelations that he has personally selected individuals for execution by drone strike, including the American citizen Anwar al-Awlaki, without, you know, any charge or trial, any due process whatsoever. It's a clear violation of the Fifth Amendment. And what we see in Washington is an effort to crack down on the leaks that exposed that illegality, not any effort whatsoever to rein in this abusive behavior or to set standards for future presidents. And I am deeply troubled by this. And even Bill Keller, who was running the New York Times when, as he put it, he allowed the regurgitation of the Bush administration lies about Iraqi WMDs, he characterized Senator Feinstein's proposed legislation to crack down on leakers as the Keep Americans in the Dark Act.
that's appropriate. I mean, Senator Feinstein is particularly interesting here because as the chair of the Intel Committee, she is basically wielding the chair of Senator Frank Church, who in the 70s took a very thoughtful, methodical, and aggressive approach to conducting his oversight responsibilities. And Frank Church was as responsible as anyone else for uncovering and trying to stop COINTELPRO. Senator Feinstein is now leading that same committee, and she is actively reinforcing executive authority. And the idea of trying to crack down on whistleblowers who we should be protecting is preposterous. And I'll just note, the Obama administration is prosecuting more national security whistleblowers than every other presidential administration in our country's history put together. It is astounding. The war on terror has become a war on transparency and a war on our own country. And I dare say that the Intelligence Committee has been just a complete disappointment in exercising its oversight responsibilities. Having said that, just to flesh out the picture on Senator Feinstein, she's also the author of the Due Process Guarantee Act, which is actually a very thoughtful, useful step forward on the NDAA, but it still could be a problem in itself. So she's tried to raise her voice to limit the military detention powers, except that her proposal itself is very limited and could be a cure even worse than the disease. And so I think, you know, Senator Feinstein, if I were to name one senator in the country who I would just, you know, quite frankly, implore the residents of a state to reach out to, Californians really need to be reaching out to Senator Feinstein right now and letting her know that we expect her to do her job.
And Shahid, she's coasting to re-election. And despite that she's, you know, on the ballot in November, the newspapers in California have offered the voters no evaluation of her role, particularly on these critical constitutional issues, as they conflict with her very expansive view of presidential power in the intelligence arena. And it's really just so frustrating to me, because the Republicans didn't even attempt to put up a serious challenge to her. And so the media just accepts that she will waltz to re-election. And the voters don't need any analysis or, you know, any review of the work that she's done in Washington. It's just astounding.
And it reflects problems with our two-party system, because, quite frankly, it shouldn't have to be a Republican to challenge her, right? I mean, there are Americans from any American, which is to say any conservative, any libertarian, any progressive, any liberal, would have very profound concerns with the record in office of Dianne Feinstein, particularly as the chair of the Intel Committee and laying down on all these investigations that she hasn't been conducting. And I just to, you know, fill that in, the Intelligence Committee actually did do a very rigorous investigation of torture and then hid the report from the American public.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, what is the point of doing your job if you're not going to actually finish the job? And I think it's really not just disappointing that there hasn't been adequate coverage of her record, but just the fact, quite frankly, that her status as an incumbent insulates her from potential electoral challenge, particularly from Democrats. I mean, I would think, I would hope that Democrats would be the first to challenge Dianne Feinstein, because she, you know, her record is hardly that, it hardly aligns with the principles that Democrats espouse, right? Even if she herself wears the label, you know, she, like many members of Congress, is governing like we live in China or the former Soviet Union. This is not reflective of the values that have long steered our country.
Shahid, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. We could go on for days because there's so many issues that we need to continue to confront. I thank you for the time and energy that you put into preserving and hopefully restoring our constitutional rights, the Bill of Rights.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you for all your work bringing attention to these issues. We're all in this together. I'd like to say that we will either stand together or we will hang alone, and I'm glad to stand together with you.
Very good. Shahid Buttar, Bill of Rights Defense Committee. Hey, send me your comments, peter@peterbcollins.com, and let's fight for the Bill of Rights. What do you say?
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.